On this episode of Baseball Barbecast, we are taking our first look at the 2025 Hall of Fame ballot, talking about the newcomers, some players that we are, of course, very familiar with. We're going to review the early awards results, Manager of the Year, Rookie of the Year, what are our takeaways from those, and preview both the Cy Young and MVP, trying to predict every player that will appear on the AL and NL MVP ballots on this episode of Baseball Barbecast.
Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbercast, the only baseball podcast in the world more excited than Paul Skeens about Paul Skeens winning the Rookie of the Year award. I'm Jake Mintz. That's Jordan Schusterman. And a little smile would have been nice.
Are you telling Paul Skeens to smile more? Shame on you, yeah. Jake. Let yes. this man live. He has been spent an entire year of people telling him to his face how awesome he is. And this was the crowning achievement where he gets to find out from Cal Ripken Jr. that he is the National League Rookie of the Year. And Paul Skeens said, hooray. It was basically the it is your birthday version of finding out you won the Cy Young Award.
It was great. But on this episode of Baseball Barbercast, we will talk about more than just Paul Skeens and his stoic response to glory. We will fly through the Hall of Fame ballot that was released earlier this week. We'll do a whole episode on the ballot later in the winter, but we just want to chat a little bit about some of the first timers who are on there. Then we'll go through the Rookie of the Year results, the Manager of the Year results, and do a fun little game trying to predict the MVP ballot. But let's begin with the Hall of Fame ballot. Jordan, the Hall of Fame means a lot to you as someone who wrote their college thesis on Hall of Fame voting. When the ballot comes out every year, what is your reaction to it typically?
So I've talked about this on the podcast before, although I'll add one kind of additional anecdote. So I did write, so I majored in communications and I ended up writing my senior thesis, which is required at my small liberal arts school, on essentially the rhetoric involved with steroids in the Hall of Fame. So it was basically looking into how voters for the Hall of Fame talk about players that use PEDs and whether they vote for them or not. And one funny aspect of that is that part of that is literally pulling dozens of pieces written on the internet or in newspapers from people who have been BBWAA members for decades who explained why they did vote for Barry Bonds or why they didn't vote for Barry Bonds or A-Rod and all these guys. And I've had many occasions, you know, since we've done this for a living, where I'm just like standing in a press box elevator and I'm like, oh, I cited your, your piece from 2004 in my college thesis. And thanks for explaining why there's no way in hell you would ever vote for, you know, XYZ. So that has been that's what the premise of the thesis was. And obviously that is still part of the discourse. However, we've also kind of moved past the majority of that discourse. Now that part of that is because Roger Clemens and Barry Bonds are no longer on the ballot. You know, we still have A-Rod and Manny, but they're just kind of stuck frozen with the amount of support that they're getting. So now, which is what we're going to talk about today, we are moving into a new era of us talking about the Hall of Fame, which is the players getting on the ballot are players that actually mean a lot to us. And that has never been more true than this year when my favorite pitcher and the entire reason I'm a Mariners fan, Felix Hernandez, is somehow on the ballot in the same year as Ichiro Suzuki. So what we're going to do today is just to kind of run through the newcomers, because again, these are players that we are intimately familiar with. Obviously, when we first started doing this, there were a lot of players on the ballot where we could conjure up opinions and feelings about them, but realistically, we only watched them so much. This is now a much more personal experience, relatively.
Getting old does indeed have its benefits. In what order would you like to go, Jordan?
I am just going to, I have the ballot up on Baseball Reference, and I feel like we should just go kind of from the top. I mean, I tweeted out the order just based by Baseball Reference War, but that's also a good way to do it from the ones who we expect that are going to be getting into the ones who are not and will spend 1 year on the ballot, and then we won't talk about them again in a Hall of Fame context. So let's just start at the top. with the two players we think have the strongest case and great chance of getting in this year on the first ballot. The first is an obvious one. It is Ichiro. The second is CC Sabathia, who I think we feel pretty good about getting into the first ballot. But let's start with Ichiro. I think Ichiro, when, you know, for years it was like, well, will we ever see a unanimous Hall of Famer? We finally got it with Mariano Rivera. Part of me wants to be like, oh yeah, Ichiro, of course. Who doesn't like Ichiro? This guy has to have one of the highest approval ratings of any, you know, baseball player of all time. And I think that that's true. However, because the voting block is ridiculous and because the likes of Ken Griffey Jr. and Derek Jeter and all these other amazing players did not get 100%, I am not holding my breath that Ichiro will get 100, but it wouldn't totally stun me.
Some hater is going to sort by war and not vote Ichiro.
They're going to sort by slugging.
By slugging, yes.
I don't know if you're sorting by war. So if you're by war, he's certainly qualified. I mean, it's not like overwhelming, but yeah.
Of course, he's qualified, but 60 wins above replacement over a career via Baseball Reference, that's Hall of Fame quality, but it's not first ballot, no doubt,
sure,
level. And so I'm sure that someone will make that argument in their brain and not vote for Ichiro right away.
But I don't think, I don't think anyone's not voting for Ichiro because of war. That makes no sense. I think they're not voting for Ichiro because they're saying he was a singles hitter. Like, I really do think it would be that. I think it's way more simple. I think that's what it is.
Worth noting on Ichiro is that every single hitter with 3,000 career hits is in the Hall of Fame. If you get to 3,000 and you don't do roids like Alex Rodriguez or Rafael Palmeiro, and you're not Pete Rose, and you're not Albert Pujols or Miguel Cabrera, who are still eligible, or still not eligible, you get in the Hall of Fame. It's literally everybody else.
Ichiro getting to 3,000 hits after debuting at age 27 is still one of the most ridiculous things you can fathom.
As a Marlin with a triple in Coors Field, it is the most brain-melting highlight that exists. So Ichiro in. Ichiro means so much to so many people because of the cultural impact. And it's not just for Japanese baseball fans or even Japanese Americans. It's for a lot of young Asian American baseball fans who aren't Japanese. I remember having a long conversation with friend of the show, Jun Lee, who's Korean, about how he loved Ichiro as his favorite player because he looked like him. And I think that that impact cannot be overstated. Yeah. He is one of the most important players of the 21st century, full stop. And I think he will get in first ballot. I do not think it will be unanimous.
Yep. And again, I think the other wild fact about Ichiro is the fact that we did not induct him last year. And the only reason for that is because he came back at the start of the 2019 season and did his two-game farewell with the Mariners playing in Japan. Obviously, it's 5 years after your last game, and those two games in the early, early, early days of the 2019 season are the reason why he has not already been inducted.
All-time dorky baseball trivia. Who entered the game for Ichiro? Do you remember?
Oh, I remember. Braden Bishop, baby. Braden Bishop, who I don't think... Did he play baseball in 2024? I don't know that he did, but he will all. And I believe that was his major league debut, which is part of the fun part of that trivia is March 21st, 2019. Here comes Braden Bishop for his MLB debut in Tokyo, and off goes Ichiro. And there were tears, and we were up at 6 a.m. to watch, and it was a wild time.
Braden Bishop running out, waving to the crowd. Thank you so much. This means thank you for cheering for me. The other guy who has a very strong chance to get in on this ballot is CC Sabathia.
This is another one where he sort of represents kind of the end of a starting pitcher generation in terms of just total compilation of stats, because he came in early enough where he could rack up just a ridiculous number of innings and pitches and complete games. And by the end of his career, we know that the expectations for the starting pitcher had changed. but this is someone who got to 3,000 strikeouts, you know, got to 3,500 innings, 250 wins. These are benchmarks we just are very unlikely to see from starting pitchers basically ever again. I mean, I always feel weird saying that because the game could change again, and maybe we do end up getting starting pitchers that are once again, you know, going deep into games the way CeCe was. But the total body of work here is pretty spectacular, and obviously one of the more popular figures and people still to this day, of course, still a very important person in the Major League Baseball space.
3,000 strikeouts does not have the same type of sexy cachet as 3,000 hits, but it is just as notable in terms of getting into the Hall of Fame. Of all the players, there are 19 of them that have 3,000 strikeouts. They're all in the Hall of Fame, except Roger Clemens, Dergs, Curt Schilling, Big Jerk, Justin Verlander, Max Scherzer still playing baseball, CeCe Sabathia. So it's like, you do this, you probably get it.
I also believe, now I know some of these other players have certainly appeared on podcasts, but I think CeCe might be the first podcaster to make Cooperstown. Wow. I know he's not doing his show with Ryan Rucco anymore, at least not with any sort of regularity. But as someone who, you know, I listen to R2C2 regularly, I think that is a historic moment here as someone regularly hosting a podcast. There's hope. There's hope for us, Jake. We could.
I would say the first player. I do think Jason Stark is in the Hall of Fame.
Okay, yes. I'm sorry. I'll keep it on. The media, we'll move the media aside. I'm just looking at, like, I don't think Scott Rolen had some podcast that I didn't know about. So credit to CeCe, but obviously just an incredible career. And you can kind of break it into these three awesome chapters. Of course, the rise in Cleveland. He wins the Cy Young there. The legendary singular second half run with Milwaukee that is one of the great kind of small sample epic runs. Not that small samples, maybe the wrong way to put it, but again, that was his only time with Milwaukee, right? So it's a unique situation. And then, of course, what he does in New York, winning the World Series in his first year there and then making some All-Star teams. So it's an awesome career.
As a person who collects jerseys, my favorite jersey in my collection is my CeCe Sabathia Brewers one, just because it was so memorable and so brief.
17 starts, 7 complete games. he was worth like 5 WAR after being acquired. 1.65 ERA. I mean, it is one of the more ridiculous runs we have ever seen. So CeCe is a legend, and I'm glad that he is still very much around Major League Baseball. Okay, so those two guys are very, very much likely going to be in the Hall of Fame. I think I would give CeCe like a 85% chance of getting in on the first ballot. Ichiro, obviously 100%. Let's keep going. Who do you want to go to next year?
I'm going to kind of throw this half into turbo mode here.
Yeah.
And you can offer some thoughts. I'm just going to go down the list in terms of WAR. Ian Kinsler is next. And Ian Kinsler is a great example of better than you remember, not good enough to be it.
I love 1,999 hits. Just couldn't quite, get there. He didn't want it bad enough. But yeah, I mean, that's basically the product of just playing awesome second base defense for an extremely long time. That's how his, not that he didn't also, wasn't also a good hitter, but in terms of the inflated WAR total, I mean, that's really what it's about.
Member of the Jewish community, thank you. Thank you. If you don't vote for Ian Kinsler, you are an anti-Semite. Moving further down the list is the non-Jewish version of Ian Kinsler, Dustin Pedroia.
I mean, kind of a forced segue there. I would say Pedroia represents a slightly different archetype, obviously also a great second baseman of his generation. And his just like burst onto the scene with the Rookie of the Year, MVP, and back-to-back years as the small, bald guy. Balding. I think balding is more accurate than bald, right? Especially at that point. But he was a very unique watch, and I know he didn't quite reach those heights. I mean, he was a hell of a player. It was a bit of a shorter peak, but my God, was he good. I mean, it was like Altuve, where it's just like, how is he doing this? Like, what is happening?
Dustin Pedroia answered the question, what if Jason Statham played baseball?
Different accent, but it's not a bad looks comp.
Pretty freaking similar.
Yeah.
Also, again, 14 years with one team, really impressive. Yep. His body just kind of abandoned him as he rounded 32 And that was just kind of deuces for him. Next on this list is Felix Hernandez. And I don't know if I want to do this now. I don't know if I want to dive all the way into this now for you.
Oh, we'll do it. We'll do it again at some point.
No player is more important to you, Jordan, than Felix Hernandez.
Yeah.
And I mean, it is Yeah, go ahead.
Again, the fact that he's on the ballot is both really cool and fun and really sad, you know? It's that simple. I mean, the fact that he didn't pitch again after 2019, the fact that his career just completely fell off as fast as it did is really frustrating and sad. But he is going to have an interesting case, and he will represent a very different generation of pitchers where the peak is indisputably Hall of Fame quality. And how much do you care about how bad it got later? We obviously have some examples of that already on the ballot with guys like Andrew Jones. I think the next player we're going to talk about, Troy Tulowitzki, also kind of falls into that category where when you're talking about his 20s, I mean, that sure looked like a Hall of Famer. And I know you could say, oh, Coors, but when you see what defense he was playing and you see the numbers he was putting up just overall in general, Tulo was unbelievable. And again, I'm obviously going to be talking about Felix more this winter, so I'm just going to save that. But, you know, it's just a different kind of case. Is that really what it's talking about? When you watch these guys at their peak, do they seem like Hall of Famers? Yes. Does that mean they're going to get in? No.
I cannot wait to cherry pick some Felix Hernandez versus Sandy Koufax in their 20s.
I mean, stats. Listen, I don't think Felix has like no shot. I just think it's extremely unlikely and it's going to take a lot of time. So that's where I'm at with that in very, very simple terms. Let's move on to Ben Zobrist. Ben Zobrist is a fascinating career, someone who kind of, we talk about, archetype. I mean, we now refer to guys as like, he could be like a Zobrist type. He could bounce around here, bounce around there. But really, nobody did it quite like him and how well he was. I mean, I guess, honestly, right now, the best comp is Edman. But Edman obviously has not been nearly, you know, the consistent offensive force that Zobrist was at his peak in Tampa Bay. But in terms of switch hitting and playing very good defense at multiple positions, that's kind of, you know, what we're talking about with Zobrist. And obviously, he was one of the faces of those Rays teams as they were getting really, really good.
Curtis Granderson is next. 16 seasons, 47 career wins above replacement, 344 home runs. He banged, dude. Curtis Granderson banged.
He also was, I mean, in terms of just, and he was awesome in Detroit, but has anyone been more perfect for the short porch? I mean, truly, right? I mean, his swing and what he was trying to do was just perfect. And that's why he goes back-to-back 40 homer seasons in 11 and 12. Another guy that, you know, the overall offensive output kind of fell off there, but a really fun player and a kind of a hell of a career. I did not realize how many different teams he played with in the last two seasons of his career.
Blue Jays, Brewers, Dodgers, Marlins.
Yeah, Marlins. I think I remembered the Marlins. I definitely forgot about Toronto, even though that was like a big part of the 2018 season.
Also one of the more beloved and respected players across the game. If you're looking for someone who could one day be in charge of the union or like be commissioner or could have like a super important job and will be like, you know, who was a great player was Curtis Granderson. Like in 30 years, that could be the conversation around him. Next up, Troy Tulowitzki, who is obviously best known for his home run as a Yankee in 2019.
Yeah. I mean, I already mentioned Tulo, I guess briefly earlier, but I mean, he was amazing. He was also one of my favorite players. And he was just so cool. And then it just, as soon as he was gone, I guess he was decent with Toronto in 16, but otherwise it was just, it went away very, very, very fast. And it was unfortunate. Obviously injuries played a part in that as well.
Russell Martin.
Mm-hmm. Russell Martin. Now this is one where the war is like, whoa, wait, what? How is he this high? Obviously when you're a good defensive catcher, you will be there for a long time. But this is a multiple-time All-Star. Like, he was a very, very good, really, really good player. And him and Brian McCann are getting on the ballot at the same time. And when you compare them to other catchers, like, you know, they're below the line, but they're really, really good careers. I mean, this is now where in the guys where it's like, I did not feel like I was watching a Hall of Famer at any point watching Russell Martin or Brian McCann for that matter, but they were awesome. And if you can be a good catcher for a long time, you certainly have my respect.
next up on this list is Hanley Ramirez, who I think if we're talking people in the bottom half, obviously Felix doesn't count, people in the bottom half of this list, to me, Hanley feels like one of the more likely players to have be on a Hall of Fame track.
Yeah, I mean, this is kind of a nebulous, like, kind of a lazy, like, almost podcasting, just like hyperbole. He has to be one of the most talented baseball players that's ever lived. Like, I don't feel bad saying that. When you consider how quickly he was just one of the best players in the league, and I know it fell off because he clearly did not keep up with whatever was necessary conditioning wise to be in a good position once he was in the later stage of his career in Boston, of course. But oh my God, I mean, just the all around talent early in Miami, and then what he was able to do in that, you know, that brief run with the Dodgers. I mean, 2013 is one of the great shortened seasons of all time. Literally, I was doing some stat heading earlier this week when the ballot came out. I mean, I believe it is a major league record for highest wins above replacement for a season under 350 plate appearances, 5.2 WAR, because he had a 1040 OPS and got MVP votes. He was just hurt for a good middle chunk of that season, but he was just so gifted. And in terms of hitters that I love going back and watching, he is just in a very, very small group whose home runs I could watch forever. And I went back and watched those two home runs he hit with Cleveland in 2019. They were both 114 off the bat rockets. And it's like, oh, it's still in there. The what was required to kind of really maintain that Hall of Fame level talent into his 30s was not there. And, you know, I'm not going to judge his character and work ethic too much, but ultimately that's just what it looked like. And in some ways it's a shame, but I do feel like I remember and can appreciate how awesome Hanley Ramirez was.
I remember his 2010 home run derby performance where he was just hitting these low line drive laser beams that just had, they looked like they had a jet pack attached to the baseball. I feel very blessed that I got to watch him play in the Dominican Winter League when I was living.
Oh yeah, there. At the end with Lise. Yeah. No, he was still obviously a legend down there. I mean, he is one of the most, I mean, accomplished Dominican players. Again, it was a short sample, but in terms of like how bright the star was burning, wow. That is a special, special talent. So Hanley, I'm sure we'll talk about him more. Again, is he going to stick on the ballot? Probably not. But he deserves his flowers for sure.
Adam Jones. Okay, so I'll do Adam Jones. Adam Jones means a lot to me. Orioles fan, no duh. He was the face of an era of a good baseball team. He was the Orioles. More than Manny Machado from 2012 to 2016. He was the best player on those teams. And then he stayed. They did not trade him. And from an emotional perspective, as a fan, having Adam Jones on the 17, 18, and 19 Orioles was very comforting. Because at the very
17,
least... 19 years with the Diamondbacks. 17 yeah. and 18, he was holding your hand through the darkness. And that really did mean a whole lot.
Yeah, and I think people who maybe are not Orioles fans, like, what do you mean? Like, Machado was obviously the guy. But, you know, Jones makes his first All-Star team in 09. You know, like, when he comes over from Seattle, like, he's pretty much immediately awesome. And so it was a much more, especially, obviously, the timing. You know, he was there first, and really, it was his team.
Machado was hurt a lot, and he was better in the years where they weren't making the playoffs. Obviously, Manny Machado, better player than Adam Jones, but it was the Adam Jones Orioles is how I will remember it. Brian McCann, you kind of clumped him in with Russell Martin a little bit earlier, and I think that's fair.
Yeah, I mean, Brian McCann was a better hitter than Russell Martin. Brian McCann won, what was it? I know I said I don't care about them, but 6 Silver Sluggers. I think for catchers, I think I maybe do care about it for that award for catchers. And 6 Silver Sluggers for a catcher and, you know, almost 300 home runs is very impressive. Again, it's not going to be at the level where he's getting serious support. But if you can squat for that long and also hit, you have my respect. Two more here, also two of our favorites. Carlos Gonzalez, another one who is kind of a co-star with Troy Tulowitzki in those Rockies years. Also in the bucket of just like as cool as it gets. As far as swings, as far as just what it looks like with the bat drop, with when he, you know, had the walk-off homer to hit for the cycle. He was, you know, he, of course, he had the customary Coors Field batting title in 2010 when he gets third in MVP, makes a couple more All-Star games, some gold gloves, a really, really, really fun player. I was honestly kind of surprised that he even ended up on the ballot. But I'm glad he's on here because it's just a reason to go back and watch his highlights.
And then of course, Fernando Rodney, who pitched in the Dominican Winter League last winter.
And I believe is still sort of trying to pitch again with Escogido this year, and it has not happened yet. This man is 47 years old and has pitched in Mexico and in the Winter League a lot since his final season with the World Series champion 2019 Nationals, which is just an amazing way to end his career. This is one of the more unique and one-of-a-kind careers in the history of the sport. And I mean, as absurd as this sounds, like the only comparison I can think of is like Satchel Paige. I mean, like in terms of just like, yeah, he's just going to go wherever and he'll pitch for until he literally cannot. again, I know the top end talent, he was not a starter, but I don't know. There's really nothing quite like this.
Sure.
And in terms of cult figures. Yeah.
Left an indelible impact on our game. One of the more memorable personalities in the sport, with the sideways hat and the arch, the archery bow thing. So in 2005, Fernando Rodney is a 28-year-old who has been absolutely horrible in 2 years as a big leaguer and then missed all of 2004 with an injury.
And like at that point, that could have been it.
Who cares? Right. And then he's like very good in 2005 and then kind of just bad for the Tigers until he's 32. Like at the age of 32, I assume he hits free agency, and through 6-7 seasons, he was worth 1.4 WAR total. And then he kicks it into gear, baby, capping it off. In 2012, Fernando Rodney finished fifth in the Cy Young. He finished fifth in the Cy Young.
Right. I mean, his peaks are one of the greatest relief seasons of all time, which is what he did in 2012. Which
five runs allowed, earned in 74 and two-thirds innings.
Yeah. And then at the end, where he's just on the 2019 Nationals. Now, he pitched. He did not pitch well. He actually pitched terribly, but he did pitch three times in the World Series in 2019. He pitched pretty well earlier in that postseason, but that was just one hell of a way to go out. And for him to be so beloved and also so despised by the teams that just because of the experience of watching him, the Fernando Rodney experience is so singular. I love this guy so much, and I hope we are still talking about him forever. And I hope he can find a way to pitch in Lidome this winter while he is on the Hall of Fame ballot. I hope he gets at least an inning.
That's the ballot. We'll reveal our ballots and talk about the returners at some point later in the winter. But for now, let's take a break. And when we get back, we'll do awards. And welcome back, Baseball Barbercast. We have half of the awards. It is Wednesday morning, and so we already know who the rookies of the year are and the managers of the year. We'll begin with the Roy, National League, Paul Skenes. In the end, it was not that close.
No. I think that we kind of discussed that voting for Merrill is totally understandable as one of the best players on one of the best teams as a 21-year-old center fielder who had never played center field before. Jackson Merrill is amazing, and I have no bad things to say about Jackson Merrill. Unfortunately, he was going up against arguably the greatest pitching season we've ever seen from a rookie, and what Paul Skenes did felt so different and so overwhelming. And the fact that it just was like, oh, he's one of the best pitchers in the league, not just one of the best rookies. And that hit everything around Paul Skenes, that he somehow lived up to the hype and more, is why he got 23 out of 30 first place votes. And yeah, it is a season we will never forget.
We joked about it earlier, Paul Skenes not reacting to finding out that he won the Rookie of the Year. You have his girlfriend, Livy Dunn, sitting next to him. You have Trey Morgan in the background, his LSU college teammate and Rays prospect. They're excited. Paul Skenes is not excited, okay? And I think this is a very interesting window into Skenes. It's not that he's not an excitable person. I think that he looks tired, as you mentioned, from talking about himself so often. He knew he was going to win, and jumping up and down like a five-year-old, I think, is just not how he moves.
Yeah.
And this did not surprise me. As someone who has had conversations with Paul Skenes, his right. stoicism in this moment did not shock me. That being said, it's certainly notable. And I don't want to come across it like Paul Skenes is not grateful, or he is not boring as a person. But this did play bizarrely on TV.
Yeah, I mean, the memes with Livy are so funny, right? I mean, her excitement combined with his blank stare is great. To me, it's as simple as you think about what Paul Skenes has accomplished this year. This was just the logical conclusion. And to your point, not that he shouldn't be excited, and I'm sure he's proud that he was Rookie of the Year, the guy started the All-Star game. So, like, it's not like we kind of knew a while ago that, like, this, and I'm sure he knew, like, this is kind of what we're working towards. The guy's a Cy Young finalist. So, if he, in a world where he won the Cy Young, I imagine there would probably be a higher level of excitement. And I think, again, his quote basically saying, like, I'm excited to put a bow on this season and look forward. Like, he has just had, he spent, you know, 6 or 8 months of talking about, oh, wow, rookie year, how are you doing this? And it's like, he's like, great, I did it. This is it. I won Rookie of the Year. Now we can move on.
That being said, Paul, it's a little fist pump. But it would have saved you a lot of trouble.
Actually would have been so funny if he was just like, yes.
Nice. Like, God, he like,
nice.
He his shortstop makes a nice play. Same reaction.
Hey, very good. And by the way, can I also just say that, like, Jackson Merrill getting 7 votes is an amazing accomplishment. I know Jackson Merrill, I'm sure knowing him, is like, you know, this is a joke. Like, I'm better than Paul Skenes, and that's what he should feel. But there have been so many unanimous rookies of the year that were nowhere near as impactful as Paul Skenes. And so Jackson Merrill getting 7 votes is not a small feat. And we should remember that as we project him forward in his career. American League. This is a little bit more interesting because we did not know who was going to win. And I think we were at least moderately surprised when Luis Gil ended up on top. Yankees right-hander wins. He gets 15 first-place votes. Colton Cowser, who we expected to maybe narrowly edge out the award because it felt like his season was a little bit more complete. And maybe in that case, we were thinking more in favor of the position player over the pitcher. Ultimately, Heal ends up with just 5 more points in the voting, and he takes home the award.
Heal, tail of two halves, first 14 starts of his season, 2.03 ERA. Last 15 starts, 5.15. Yeah. ERA. I would have voted for Cowser, I think. And I think if you voted for Heal, that's also fine. This just kind of felt like a weird Rookie of the Year case just because of how much Heal fell off. Yet when you look at the whole body work of his season, it is very impressive, especially for someone who entered spring training not expecting to be in the rotation and was only thrust into that role when Gerrit Cole went down. Good for him. Great for Yankees pitching development that they did this. It's just, Matt Blake, you're a god.
Yeah, no, it's, and again, obviously it was an uneven season, but that first 2 months, I mean, he was as good as it gets. He was untouchable. And even with walking the world, he was one of the hardest guys to hit in the league, and definitely an interesting pitcher to project moving forward. And we are, I think, fine with that result.
Manager of the Year, which is so dumb. even though you voted for it, the thing with Manager of the Year is this: the real Manager of the Year is whoever wins the World Series. And I know it shouldn't be that simple, but it is. Manager of the Year is based off of how good did we think you were going to be? How good were you? And you know that because when you look at the results and you see that Dave Roberts got 3 third place votes, it's like, well, didn't he do the best job?
So, right. So this is especially one of the big challenges of voting before the postseason, because the time we talk about managers the most is in the postseason. And as soon as you submit your ballot, you're watching some of these managers get eliminated, which is exactly the case for me. As I submit my ballot for Pat Murphy, I was one of 27 of the 30 voters who voted for Pat Murphy first place. And then, of course, the Brewers immediately flame out at the hands of Carlos Mendoza, who I voted for second. I was apparently in the minority of people who voted for Mendoza over Schilt. I had Schilt third. And again, like, obviously, it's not like my ballot was that wild and there were other people with it and Murphy won in a landslide. So it is what it is. I'll just explain quickly. I think my Mendoza over Schilt, it kind of was a late thing because of just how that final week for the Mets went. And maybe that was unfair to kind of go with. But I also was kind of thinking about it. It's, yes, of course, the Mets have a massive payroll and they have a lot of superstar players as well. But I still feel like the Padres season was as much of an achievement of the front office as it was the team that was, the manager. And I think Schilt's awesome. I voted him third and I was considering him second for sure. But I think the job and what San Diego did compared to 2023 is also super impressive. But I just think that, managing in New York is a different thing. As a first time manager for sure with Mendoza, kind of everything that with went going in with that. And then Murphy, for me, it was just like, again, the narrative of them and the expectation for the Brewers and having Council leave and then immediately, kick the Cubs' ass all year is just too good to pass up. And obviously most of the voters agreed with me.
Also, Council never won this. Council never won this. And so for Murphy to be the first Brewers manager to win the Manager of the Year award, Council never won. Council never won. He finished.
Certainly didn't get any votes this year.
He was a runner-up 4 times, and he never won.
Wow.
And yet,
how about that?
Pat Murphy, in his first chance, gets a win. There were some very bizarre down-ballot votes in the National League. Quick word on that. If you are a voter, okay, voting presents a very difficult scenario for you. If you vote for the person in your market that you see every day, if I'm covering, I'm picking a team out of a hat. If I'm covering the Diamondbacks and I have to go in there and maintain a good relationship with Torrey Lovello every day and I vote for Torrey, that helps me. I'm incentivized to do that. If I don't vote for Torrey, the players are going to dislike me. And that's the case for every award, but it is most the case for this because the manager is the conduit to the team. And I think that is part of the reason why you see some wonkier stuff for Manager of the Year, where you're like, Rob Thompson, first place vote from one guy. Well, guess what? That guy probably has to talk to Rob Thompson all the time. And why? Who cares if you put him first?
Yeah.
Right.
I think your point is totally valid. I don't want to overrate the degree to which managers and players care about this, but it's not nothing. They're all human, right? And this comes into play with voting for players as well, I think, to some degree. And it is a challenge of this. And I know that some people feel strongly about how this process goes, but I think it's a reasonable one. And it's a big enough sample size that usually it doesn't sway things too strongly.
I agree. I don't think you should be able or allowed to vote for players in your own market because of how the voting breaks down. There are two people voting from every market, and I think it would just even itself out. I just think it would remove a lot of the bias that goes into this.
Yeah, I mean, then you would have situations where you basically never have unanimous winners anymore, which could be unfortunate. True. I mean, does that matter? I don't know. I've heard a recommendation like that before, and as very junior members of the BBWAA, I don't really want to act like we have all the answers. but obviously, I feel fortunate to have been able to vote the last couple of years, and we'll see if I do again as I now move to the Cleveland chapter next year.
Keith Law voting for Oliver Marmol third place vote. Keith, you're in my doghouse. I'm going to save that for Friday's episode for Good, Bad, Ugly.
That's fine. I do want to shout out one more vote here before we move to MVP. I don't know who Steve Kroner of the San Francisco Chronicle is, and I have to imagine where he voted is relevant. However, this man voted Mark Kotze second. And I got to say...
We haven't done American League yet, Jordan. We haven't said Stephen Vogt's name. Oh. So you're getting ahead of yourself here.
Oh, I'm sorry. We were still stuck on National League. Well, okay. Well, no, this was my number one takeaway. Not Stephen Vogt, who I watched obviously guide the Guardians to a division title and then into the, you know, all the way to the CS. Let me just get this out of the way. Mark Kotze getting a vote here is amazing. And I actually love it so much. Would I vote him? I don't know. Probably more likely third than second. But talk about a tough job and someone who actually had the A's winning games in the second half of the year. I like that. But anyway,
I would have given Kotze a third place vote. I think that how well that team played in the second half, leaving that market, I think, to me, giving it to him over like Hinch or Quattraro, who were just like AL Central manager overperformed, right? Like, that feels more right to me. That being said, I would have had vote first on my ballot.
No, I mean, I saw it up close. Just the fact that this guy was able to figure out this job this quickly. And you know, I've talked on here a lot about how strong the staff is around him, and Stephen Vogt's talked about that too. But it's pretty remarkable. And while Cleveland, the infrastructure, of course, has been stronger and more successful in recent years compared to Detroit and Kansas City, and so maybe them winning the division is not as shocking as, you know, the Royals bouncing back from 100 losses, they won this incredibly competitive division, and that is not a small thing. And ultimately, I am, as clearly for most of these voters, when you're lining up all these AL Central ones, it's like, are you really going to vote for the one that didn't end up winning the division, that was close and they had to fend off these guys? And Vogt is obviously a very popular guy from his playing days, and he deserves this. It's a really, really cool story.
Voting for Baldelli over Hinch, as someone did, just tells me that they wrote and submitted the ballot in like the middle of September, right? Right? You just submitted the ballot in September before the Twins pooped their pants and the Tigers showed up.
Yeah,
which is an embarrassment, and you shouldn't be allowed to do that.
Yeah, no, I know. And other than that, I don't see too many other, you know, Cora getting a third place vote, Boone getting a second place, Espada finishing fourth was interesting. I really was not thinking about him too much, but probably should have, considering what the Astros went through injury wise.
I think Boone is the most overlooked person on this list. I mean, mm-hmm. they had the most wins in the American League, and they won the American League East, and he was the manager of the Yankees. That's the thing. It's all about expectation, right? It's almost impossible for the manager of the Yankees to win manager of the year.
For sure. I think his biggest issue was the opposite of the AL Central dynamic, where the AL East was disappointing, relatively. I know the Orioles were good, but I think that's where it was harder to get as excited about him delivering what the expectation was.
All right. We have the Cy Young coming up tonight.
Yes.
And that result feels pretty much done and dusted.
Yes. And I just wanted to talk about that a little bit because I am writing about Tarek Skubal, who we expect to win the AL, and Chris Sale, who we expect to win the National League. This is just the third time in the awards history, Jake Mintz, that both winners are left-handed. How about that? It feels impossible. Again, there have been many, many lefty winners over the years. But this is only the third time. 1977, Sparky Lyle and Steve Carlton. 2002, Barry Zito and Randy Johnson. And now we are assuming, barring a shocking Zach Wheeler nail-biting victory, that it will be Chris Sale and Tarek Skubal. And what I ended up writing about, and just what I think is so fascinating, is like Skubal, while he is an interesting trajectory as someone who was a ninth round pick and from a school that there were very few big leaguers and all these things, and kind of he just burst on the scene. And once he got healthy and got good, it was like, okay, I'm an ace and now I win the Cy Young. Very straightforward. It's like coming into the year, it's like, oh, Tarek Skubal, that guy looks like a Cy Young candidate. And he did it. He did it. He did the thing. Tigers win the postseason. Amazing. Chris Sale was an ace, also about as fast as you could get, and yet it took him 12 more years to ultimately win this award, finishing in the top six, seven straight years and never ultimately winning it. And then going through 3 years of injuries where it was like, we ain't never seeing that guy again. And then to come back and win it is just remarkable. And I know his season ended on kind of an ominous note, but I hope that we still have elite Chris Sale in the future. But at the very least, it seems likely he will be able to celebrate this season with Atlanta with the Cy Young he has long been chasing.
All right, let's take a quick break. And when we get back, we'll look at the MVP race and throw things into turbo mode.
And we are back here on Baseball Barbacast. Now it is time to look ahead to the MVP ballot, the MVP award, which will be announced on Thursday evening. And what I wanted to do is play a little bit of a guessing game. This is something that I did a couple of years ago when it was Judge and Otani, and it was like, okay, Judge Otani, this is the debate. And I was like, okay, we know Judge and Otani will be the top two. But what happens after that? Because when you vote for MVP, unlike for Cy Young, when you get five spots and Manager of the Year, where you get three spots, Rookie of the Year, three spots, you have 10 spots to vote for the MVP award. You must list 10 players. And because of that, every year we get a lot more than those three finalists that we know about already. We usually get on average between 20 and 25 names that appear on the MVP ballot. And while we are not voting on this award this year, maybe we will be fortunate enough to do so in the future. What we are going to do is try and guess which players in total will end up on this ballot. And we're going to go through this pretty quickly because we have established, we talked this out yesterday, kind of picked our locks. But this is going to be a game that we're going to go back and review the results on Friday and see how many of these that we can get correct. Because there's a lot of, well, once you get down into the 7th to 10th place, there's a lot of things that could drive those votes because the stakes feel smaller and there's other things that could maybe push you. And, you know, what market you're in, I'm sure definitely influences that as well, can push voters to go in certain directions. So let's begin. NL or AL first? Yeah.
We get to 22 players getting votes. That happens every year, even though you are only voting for 10. And so we're going to try and nail the bottom of the ballot. I'm going to fly through the NL, okay?
Yes. Let's give our locks. We're like, these guys will get votes and we don't have to talk about them.
We have 15 players who are locks in our minds. Shohei Ohtani, pretty good. Francisco Lindor, Ketel Marte, Ellie De La Cruz, William Contreras, Jackson Merrill, Bryce Harper, Marcelo Zuna, Matt Chapman, Jurickson Profar, Willie Adames, Teoscar Hernandez, and the three pitchers who are Cy Young finalists, Chris Sale, Zach Wheeler, Paul Skenes.
Yes. Now, we should note about the pitchers. Usually, on average, there's three to four pitchers that end up on the ballot. We are kind of defaulting to the Cy Young finalists, even though it is a different voting block, right? The people who voted for Cy Young are not the same ones that voted for MVP. But that's just the easiest way to do it. Maybe we'll end up adding a couple pitchers. So those 15, we feel like they will be getting at least one 10th place vote. We did that. That was not listed in any specific order. We're not going to worry about the order. We're just trying to get the names.
But guess what? There will be more. There has to be. That's most just likely how this works.
Yes, yes.
Here's the next group. Mookie Betts, feel pretty good about that. Missed a lot of time if he was more healthy.
It. Narrative, play the shortstop. Dodgers, I think, yes.
Then it's Kyle Schwarber and Seiya Suzuki, who you can kind of lump together as big DH bros who hit the ball hard quite a few just times.
Awesome hitters. Awesome hitters. Yep.
Freddie Freeman. Freddie, really good season. He's really good. Remember, they vote on this before the playoffs. Okay.
and this was a sort of down regular season. We know he was dealing with some injuries. We know he was dealing with off the field, but it's still a hell of a season. I mean, you still put it up there. It's one of the best offensive seasons in the National League.
Problem for him is that Ohtani, Teoscar, and Mookie are probably all ahead of him.
Yeah, I feel strongly that Teoscar, as someone who basically didn't miss any games and was just very much the most consistent guy for them, is going to end up on here. But I still like Freddie as one of our locks.
And then the other dude we have on this group is kind of a shot in the dark, and it's Gino Suarez, third baseman for the Arizona Diamondbacks, for kind of a classic throwback MVP argument, which is he played in almost every game, played good defense at third, and had over 100 RBIs.
Yes. And for the best offense in baseball. So as we bring in some other candidates here, you could certainly argue that there are other Arizona Diamondbacks that belong, a second Diamondback. And so now let's open it up. We have given you 20 names. Maybe we are ridiculous for putting Gino as one of the 20 that we are definitely picking. Here are the other ones we are considering. We can pick some of them. We can pick none of them. Okay. Another Padre, Tatis Machado. Let's put them out there. Another D-back, Corbin Carroll, Christian Walker. Would you put them over Gino Suarez? Jackson Churio, of course, another Brewer we could put on there as a division winner. Another Met from Francisco Lindor. Could it be Pete Alonso, who played 162 games but was kind of not that awesome? Could it be Mark Vientos? Again, before the postseason, but still, awesome year for him. The Phillies had a great record, and we'll have Bryce Harper and maybe Kyle Schwarber on there. Would we see Trey Turner and Alec Boehm?
Zach Wheeler, too.
Zach Wheeler. Oh, right. We already have Zach Wheeler. That's true. Probably not Nola. Christopher Sanchez? He had a high war. Probably not. Then you have, like, if you're just sorting by war, Dansby Swanson. I'm not really buying that one. More on the defense candidates in the AL. Then you have some small sample guys. Wilson Contreras was awesome, but he played like 90 games. Tyler Fitzgerald, awesome. Again, 90 games. Jose Iglesias, talk about changing a team's season. Okay, we're moving him aside. And then we have four other pitchers. Logan Webb, Reynaldo Lopez, who was amazing when he pitched. Imanaga for the Cubs, I think is a strong case. Also got some down ballot rookie of the year votes. And then Ryan Helsley, who's basically the closer. We're going to talk about Class A in the AL. Helsley, by far the best closer in the National League. So that's candidate. Of these guys that we just said, who do you feel strongly about?
Give me Carroll. Mm-hmm. Give me Churio. Mm-hmm. Jackson Churio. And give me Brenton Doyle. Colorado Rockies center fielder, elite defender, average offensive season. I'm going to add those three guys to the bottom of my list. Okay.
You're adding
Churio. 21, my 21, 22, 23. Are Churio, Carroll, and Brenton Doyle.
Churio, Carroll, Doyle. Okay, that is wild. I am going to go with... I'm going to go with Carroll. I'm going to go with Imanaga as another pitcher. Okay. And I am going to go... Oh, Helsley. Oh, man. I am going to go with Helsley, actually. I think there's usually one reliever in each league. And then I'm going to add one more. I'm going to go one more here. Okay. And I think I am going to go with, I'm between Tatis and Churio. And I think I'm going to go with Tatis. So those are my additional four. So I'm going to go 24. Sorry, Logan Webb. I know he got down ballot votes last year. I just don't think he was quite as good. I'm going to go with our 20. Suarez, we're locking in. With Carroll, Imanaga, Helsley, Tatis. Sorry, Machado. And another Met. Oh, no other Met? Jake, you going to walk into that clubhouse and say you didn't vote for these guys?
I didn't fake vote. Okay, let's move to the American League. Okay. We have 14
Doyle,
locks.
Amazing. Yes.
14 go. Locks.
Let's hear those locks.
Judge, Witt, Soto, Gunner, Duran, Ramirez, Jose Ramirez, Vladimir Guerrero Jr., Cal Raleigh, Yordan Alvarez, Brent Rooker, Tarek Skubal, Emmanuel Clase, Riley Green, and Anthony Santander. Okay, that's our, I feel great about all those guys getting a vote. Our next group down, Corey Seager, really good, hurt a lot, didn't play a whole lot of
games. He wasn't as hurt that much. I mean, he was hurt, but, you know, he played over 100 games.
Rafi Devers, Stephen Kwan, Kyle Tucker, who if he played like 20 more games would be a lock of all locks. I mean, he was unbelievable.
But was still with the 180 WRC plus, we are still putting him in the lock, which is maybe dangerous. We have a couple other small sample superstars, but we're keeping Kyle Tucker. I think he was so good. I'm having him on here as lock.
And then two Royals, Salvador Perez and Seth Lugo, their catcher and their best pitcher. And I think that like, the Royals were such a story. Having just Bobby Witt Jr. on this list doesn't feel right. That's our 20. I don't feel good about the last group.
Yeah, I feel worse about this 15 to 20 than I do about 15 to 19 in the NL. But let's just stick with the 20, and then we'll go with the debate. Okay, so we'll lock in those 20. We'll ride with those together. Here are the other candidates. Another Astro: Jose Altuve, Yainer Diaz, Ronel Blanco? Question mark. I'm gonna throw him in there.
Out of here, dog.
It's a starting pitcher. Defense and blah bat: Dalton Varsho, Marcus Semien. Jake, gonna make the Varsho case here in a second. Lawrence Butler, one of the best hitters in baseball for the last 2 months. Gonna throw him in there. Josh Naylor has a similar argument to Suarez as the 30 homer, 100 RBI, one of the best hitters on a team that was very good. So I have to mention him. And then the three other pitchers to mention would be Logan Gilbert, who led Major League Baseball in innings, Crochet, which would be amazing if a White Sox gets an MVP vote. But, I mean, there's certainly no question about him being the MVP of the White Sox, so that's for sure. And then Cole Reagans, who you could argue was better than Lugo. He just didn't throw as many innings. Smaller sample guys, you know, Buxton, Correa, Kerry Carpenter. They were great, but we'll move them aside. Who are you feeling about here?
I'd like to propose that we put Josh Naylor in at 21 together.
Okay. Yeah, I'm fine with that.
Okay.
Did he get votes? I believe he got votes. Did he? Because he had a better season than last year. Did he get down ballot votes last year when he? Yeah, he did. Okay. I'm good. I'm good with Naylor. I mean, the OPS plus was lower, but he had more homers. And all right, I'm good with Naylor.
I'd like to cross off Lawrence Butler for the following reason. Anybody who votes for Lawrence Butler, as amazing as he was, has to also be voting for Brent Rooker.
And they've already voted for him. And so,
and you can't justify two Oakland A's being on your ballot. You can't. You can't. Okay. You can't.
That's fine. That's fine. Okay. Butler's off.
I'm going to add Altuve just because he's always good and he was good again. Okay. He's on my list. Okay.
Okay. Yep.
So I'm taking Altuve, and then I'm going to take Dalton Varsho. Here's why.
I mean, if you're taking Doyle, you might as well take Varsho.
Dalton Varsho is an amazing defensive center fielder and does so much cool stuff that somebody who saw Dalton Varsho do something cool was like, well, I'll put him 10th. I think that's happening. Kevin Pillar got a vote. This is the Kevin Pillar Memorial vote.
Okay, I am going to go with, I'm going to go Semien, just because people respect the hell out of Marcus Semien. I am not going to go Altuve. I am going to go Gilbert, and I'm going to go Crochet. Gilbert, to me, is Logan Webb from last year, and he got votes last year. And then Crochet is just a fun one to pick. Someone on one of the worst teams in baseball history who was, I mean, he was singular and definitely stood out on his horrible team.
You have convinced me of Gilbert. I'm adding Gilbert to my list. So my three additional guys are Altuve, Dalton Varsho, and Gilbert.
Okay. My additional guys are, do I not want to pick Altuve? That seems kind of wild. No, I'm going to stick with Semien. I'm going to stick with Semien. I'm going to go Gilbert, Crochet, Semien. And we've locked
I'm so excited. I'm so excited to review this. Now, just so everyone knows, I, Jake Mintz, am not going to look at the specific down ballot voting results on Thursday night. And Jordan will announce this to me live for the first time on the show on Friday. So please stay tuned for that.
Oh, we should also say we have not asked people who have votes. Like, this is very much, we're going in blind. I mean, I'm sure when we see who voted, we will know these people, but this is very much just let's do our best here and we will see. Okay. This is going to be fun. All right, Jake, before we get out of here, let's fly through a couple of bits of news. Let's just do two things here.
Turbo! Let's go mode!
We're flying through it. Juan Soto, two more meetings on the books. He met with the Yankees earlier this week, and it sounds like he will also be meeting with the Phillies and the Dodgers. Between the Phillies and the Dodgers, which one compels you more?
The Phillies compel me more. The Dodgers should meet with everybody all the time because they have so much money. The Phillies getting a Juan Soto meeting when he doesn't fit their roster as obviously tells me that their owner, John Middleton, is still freaking understandably pissed from the way that they lost and not demanded a meeting, but insisted upon one. Yep. And I am fascinated to know how that goes. Worth noting that he being Juan Soto, is still very, very, very close with Phillies hitting coach Kevin Long, who was the hitting coach in DC when Soto was there.
Mm-hmm. And again, when you mentioned the roster fit, whereas the Dodgers right now, if Mookie Betts is playing the infield, really don't have any outfielders. So in that sense, it makes sense. But it also just seems like if you're Boris, yeah, you take all these meetings. Duh. I think what I'm excited about is on Friday to find out what very generic positive adjectives are ascribed to these meetings.
Do you want me to try and report that?
Should I be like, he was impressed?
Should I try and be that guy? Should I, like, for the Phillies? You know, I got Philly shooters. Should I pick up the phone and ask
find out
how
if he was
it
impressed?
Went? Was Juan Soto impressed? Was he horrified?
Went well. Anyway,
it went well.
I'm sure we will laugh about whatever comes out of those meetings on Friday. The qualifying offer deadline passed and only Nick Martinez accepted. We already talked about that. First eyebrow-raising trade of the winter was not Jerry DePoto reacquiring Austin Shenton, although that made me laugh. Jose Siri to the New York Mets. Whoa. Whoa. Now, if you just look at it as a baseball thing, it's like, well, they had Harrison Bader and they need a really good defensive center fielder and he will be helpful for them in some form. But Jose Siri is a much more, it's one of the more ridiculous baseball savant pages that you really have because he's one of the fastest players with one of the best arms, one of the best defenders. He can hit the ball really hard and he strikes out so much and swings at everything. And teams have been tantalized by his physical abilities for now going on like 10 years. And the Mets are the latest to ride the Jose Siri roller coaster.
Jose Siri is a volatile baseball player and a volatile character. He is beloved and despised by people around the game because his energy is unrelenting and at times invigorating and at other times utterly exhausting.
I think at the very least, we can credit him for becoming a regular major league player. Because in the minor leagues, he was so unpredictable as far as just a player and honestly a personality from everybody that, you know, knew him coming up with the Reds, that it was like, I don't know if this is going to work. And the fact that he has found a way to be a major leaguer that teams still want is impressive. But his physical abilities are really, really remarkable. So how important is it really? I don't know, but I'm sure this Eric Orsi guy is going to have a 2 ERA for the Rays next year in 90 innings, I'm sure.
That's our show.
That is our show. It was a good show, I think. Tell us if we're wrong. Email us, baseballbarbacast@gmail.com. That's BARBcast. We appreciate those emails from the listeners. Maybe we'll get to some of them on Friday. Big show on Friday. Not only will we reveal the MVP ballots, but maybe quite a fun special guest coming up.
We will talk about the 2024 MVP and also talk to the 2025 MVP.
Thanks for listening. Thank you, producer Andrew Hartz. We will talk to you all on Friday.